All right, 1 Kings chapter 11, and very important lessons to learn from this chapter, and we've already spent a couple of weeks digging into this material here in the beginning of the chapter. We want to continue with that. We've been digging, but we haven't mined at all. There's lots in there, and very important lessons for us all to remember. Applications of it that are very pertinent for us still today. But let's go there to 1 Kings chapter 11. And let's read verses 1 through 10 once more. And we'll ask Brother Aaron to read that for us as we start here.
Verse
10. 1 through 10. Okay, so in verse 1, he begins to tell us what happened to Solomon, where he goes wrong now. What's the main problem? His wives. Well, how many did he have there in verse 3? Well, 1,000. Now, he breaks it into two kinds of wives. They're still wives. 700 wives, 300 concubines, and we went through the definition of what a concubine was. In that time, that would be the servant of one of his wives when given as another wife. So they had a special category for that wife. Hagar was an example of that, and that we looked at with the handmaiden of Sarai that she gave to Abram and... of course, she became the mother of Ishmael, but that was a concubine. Well, he had 300 of those, so they would have been handmaidens among the 700 wives that he married. So all told, he had 1,000 wives. Now, what was the problem with that, and what was the effect of that? Well, what does he say about those wives in verse 3? So the 700 that had their status not as a concubine, but those 700 were what in verse 3?
Princesses.
So that lets us know what was involved in Solomon's strategy for marrying all these women. And what would be the basis for that? I mean, was there... was this calculated? Obviously, for these wives to be princesses, this was something that Solomon was consciously doing for a reason, a purpose. Well, what would that accomplish? And we already saw the example of it in the previous chapter with the one that he mentions right here. The first one he mentions in verse 1, the daughter of Pharaoh. Well, I mean, what does that do when you and that's what a princess is. You marry the daughter of another king. What does that do?
It's hard to be your enemy when your daughter's there, right?
That's right. So there's a lot of and was Solomon the only one that ever did this? Well, I mean, back in 100 years ago, even. Because there's been a lot of we're in 100 years since 100 years ago World War I was going on, but at that time most of the European nations had what form of government 100 years ago? Most of them were monarchies still at that time, and many of them still have those. Positions, not all of them, but most of them are just kind of serve a constitutional purpose. But if you were to go back and you look at the history of it, just, I mean, the reason we're using this example right now or that I am is because this was just 100 years ago. I mean, my grandmother remembered that time, those years. So it's not that far removed from us is the point there. Even though we didn't live through that. I mean, that's really not that long ago. That's the point here. But even in that time, all those monarchies in Europe, almost every one of them, they were all related. Most of them were related. They were cousins. They were, and most of them actually could trace their ancestry back to one woman, the one that was referred to as the grandmother of Europe. That was Queen Victoria of England. Most of her grandchildren were those in the royal families of all those European nations, because all those intermarriages, doing exactly what we're reading about here. So just showing that even down to our modern times, this sort of thing was taking place. So this is not anything unusual for marriages to be made for strategic purposes, royal families tying together for political reasons and all of that. So that was involved there. What's the problem with that? Well, we looked at several things about it. We looked at several scriptures. In fact, we looked at several passages in one book of Deuteronomy. What he mentions there in verse 1 immediately exposes what's wrong with that. What was wrong with what Solomon did? Or was there anything wrong with it? Yes, there was. What was wrong with it? Well, what did we read in Deuteronomy? We had three different chapters that we looked at. In the book of Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy 7, what was that? The beginning of that chapter, the first several verses of Deuteronomy 7, what was that about? Well, that was an explicit commandment from God for the people of Israel not to marry any of the men or women of those Canaanite nations that God pronounced a death sentence upon. And he told them why they were not to marry any of them. They were to utterly destroy them. What kind of people were they? Well, what made them worthy of God pronouncing utter destruction on all of them, with them not to leave any alive that breathed? That was the phrase that God used about that. What kind of people would they be to be worthy of God to say all of them are to be destroyed, don't leave alive any that breathes? Well, there was a reason God waited four centuries from when he prophesied that this would happen, when speaking to Abraham in Genesis 15 before bringing it to pass. He didn't do it in Abraham's time. God would not have been unable to have done it right then, would he have? I mean, he could certainly have made all that happen very quickly, but there was a reason he gave to Abraham in Genesis 15 as to why he was going to keep his people in what turned out to be Egypt, in that strange land where they would be ill-treated for that time, be in bondage. Then God was going to bring them out with great substance, but he gave a reason why there in Genesis 15 about the Amorites. What was not yet what? The wickedness of the Amorites, he said, was not yet full. So for them, for God to pronounce that sentence for them to be utterly destroyed meant they had to be what? Literally, fully wicked. So in Deuteronomy 7, he was giving a commandment to his people not to marry anyone of these nations that were fully wicked. Their wickedness was yet full now at that point. What was it going to do for them if they were marrying people from nations that were fully wicked?
First
Corinthians 15:33, and it's still true. That's why he starts that verse with, "Be not deceived." Because it's very easy for us to convince ourselves, to rationalize, to justify, and all those things, to convince ourselves that, well, this really isn't going to hurt me. I'll be able to handle this. The devil wants to deceive us with that. That father of lies. Well, I mean, how many of the lies does he get us to tell ourselves? Deceiving ourselves that we think that we can handle something. But God says, don't be deceived about this. This will corrupt you. And that's what he told us, the people in Deuteronomy 7. And said, do not marry those people because they will turn away your hearts from me. We also looked at passages in Judges chapters 2 and 3 where God repeated that. And we know that's exactly what happened. He says that's what ended up happening to the nation. And Solomon had those examples. So he had the commandment and the example of what happened to generations in Israel that did not obey that commandment. So what was wrong with this? Well, number one, he disobeyed a commandment of God. So Deuteronomy 7 said, don't do it, and he did it anyway. What did Deuteronomy 23 say, particularly verse 3? A couple of those nations that he mentions, the ones that he starts with in 1 Corinthians 11, 1. Moab and Ammon, they had special status. Now, they were not of those seven nations in Canaan that God pronounced utter destruction to. He told them to leave those nations, Moab and Ammon, alone, not to destroy them, and they couldn't take their land. And because they were the children of whom?
Lot.
Yes, by his daughters, and what happened after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, they were those were the two sons that were of Lot's daughters by him, based on what his daughters had done, that evil. But what kind of nations did they become? Well, Moab and Ammon were wicked nations, just like Edom, that was descended from Esau. If you go back to Genesis, what went wrong with Esau? He married those daughters of Heth, and it vexed the heart of his parents. Now Jacob saw that, and then he determined, "I'm not going to do like that." And he went to the house of Laban. So he had a different standard for who he was going to marry. He did not want to emulate his twin brother seeing what he did because he married those wicked women. And what did his descendants become? There's so much overlap in this. You can see these ones that God said, don't marry the people from these nations. Well, they were wicked. And they got wicked. We can trace it back in a lot of cases back to the original bad decisions that the fathers of those nations made. And who they married. And you see the result of how that went wicked. We saw the ultimate example of that in Genesis 6, when the whole world, every imagination of the heart of man was only evil continually. In Noah's time, and there were only 8 people in the ark, one family of all the earth that was saved then, and it started because the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and so they married them because they were pretty. Well, here Solomon married these women because they were princesses. In Deuteronomy 17, that was the chapter that specifically addressed kings of Israel and told them not to multiply wives to themselves. So there were commandments, Deuteronomy 23, don't marry anyone of Moab and Ammon, don't have them in your congregations because they refused to help the Israelites when they came through their land up on the east side of Jordan before they conquered Canaan. So God gave those commandments for his people not to marry any of those Canaanite nations, anyone from Moab or Ammon, and for the kings not to multiply wives to themselves. And Solomon broke all those commandments that God made concerning their marriages. Well, it comes down to this. What was the basis and the reason for all those commandments God gave about who they were going to marry? And we can see there people have different reasons for who they marry. And we can see what was involved with Solomon here. All right. What are some of the reasons that we see? What do we see in Genesis 6? The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair. What does that mean? Does that mean they treated everybody fairly? What is that word fair? We read those old fairy tales, once upon a time, and when you read about the fair lady or the fair maiden, what does it mean? What's that?
Beautiful.
Yeah. Looks. Nobody does that anymore, do they? They don't end up deciding to get involved with somebody or end up marrying somebody based on their look, the way they look on the outside. Is that still an issue? God's not commanding to go out and find somebody ugly. I mean, that's not what that means. But is that what we're, if that is the standard, that's the reason why we are marrying somebody, what can happen there?
Same thing that happened here.
Yeah, because that's the outside, that's a physical reason to marry somebody. Well, what's another? What do we see here in 1 Kings 11?
Political.
Yeah, political reasons. And let's see, kind of along with that, political also involves ultimately what? Well, I mean, and this was certainly a factor there. I mean, Solomon, there would be at least two things he would get out of the political expediency for these marriages. He would have peace with those different kingdoms, but not only that, he's bringing in their daughters, and what are they bringing with them? What did Pharaoh's daughter bring with her?
Well,
yeah, money. You got dowries and all that. This is something we had to deal with regularly over in India. That's still a huge issue in their culture. With dowries, they don't. In fact, in India, they don't. That's another reason why they favor having sons so much. Because if you have daughters when they get married, then you have to give a dowry to send that to the with the groom. So basically, it's the groom's family. They arrange their marriages there, and this is what the basis of their arrangement. It's based on. Well, if you have a son, well, then you can get a big dowry if you arrange a marriage with this family that has money, because then that money's going to go to you, on behalf of your son. Well, the ones that have a lot of daughters, see, I wouldn't be in a good situation if I were over in India, because I'd have dowries to give out times four. Same with Jan. We would be at the bottom there. Now, you know, Edward Carlton, he would be absolutely on the top in India. Wish he were here right now. But anyway, of course, they kind of blew it when they had the girl last. But yeah, that would be their dream, to have that many kids and all be sons, because you get money for every one of those. And so they arrange their marriages on that basis. We deal with this in the church over there, because a lot of families, that's so ingrained in their culture, and they arrange their marriages for that reason. We've seen many Christian families, situations with Christian families where they still have that thinking, and they're still arranging a marriage with a different family, but it's based on that. Well, when you look at all these different reasons, do people still marry for money? Is that involved in anybody's decisions to marry? I mean, I'm just using that example over there. And by the way, that's such an issue there. In a population, do you know what... In a general population, for normal statistics, If you have 100 females in a population, for every 100 females, how many males should there be?
100.
Yes. Now, on average, in a normal population, there's usually, there will be 102 females for every 100 males, because on an average, at least two guys have done something stupid to get themselves bumped off by the time. But anyway, that has to do with the Y chromosome, I think. But in seriousness, that over an average population, that is the case, where you'll have 102 females for every 100 males. Do you know what the numbers are in India? For every 100 males, there's 91 females. So you've got for every 100, and if you think about, and this is for a country that has a population of 1.25 billion people, for every 200 people of that billion and a quarter, there are 11 or 12 missing females in the population. Now you multiply that over how many people are in that country, what happened to them, where are they? They kill them. There's a in India, it's against the law nationally to reveal a child's gender on an ultrasound before they're born. You know why? Because they will abort. But what do they do in villages where people don't have healthcare, where they can get an ultrasound? That's just the rich people in India that didn't get that. But in the villages, what do? It's after they're born. Infanticide is rampant. Same in China. Numbers are very similar in China for the same reason. Those are the two most populous nations on earth. But they'll kill female infants when they're born because they don't want to end up later on having to pay the dowry for that. So then they get issues with, you got a lot of guys running around over there that can't find brides because they're the women are scarce. So if you don't have a family that would attract a dowry, then you're going to be left out. But anyway, I know those are a lot of different things we're talking about, but it's just illustrating, if you're going to have that many babies murdered in this world for that reason, I mean, that just shows how big an issue that still remains on earth today. I know this is some things we don't even think about a lot as Americans. We don't go to that kind of extent, but we still see the issues and people, all those things, you know, political reasons, looks, money, all those things are still very much involved in marriages and choosing who somebody's going to marry. But what's common about all of those reasons? Absolutely. These are all physical things, physical reasons. They are not the one reason and the only reason that should really count. And that's spiritual. And there's a lesson, and that's why I said there's so much to learn in so many different applications of this. But this is a huge example of what happens when we make life decisions based on reasons other than the one and only reason that should be the basis for all our decisions. That's what is the first and greatest commandment? To love God with all of our heart and soul and mind and strength. That's number one. Okay, now, which tells us every other commandment that God gives us is going to come from that. That's going to be the basis for all the other commandments. Now, the next commandment that Jesus said was the second greatest, which is based on that, is love thy neighbor as thyself. Of course, Jesus gives us the new commandment that's even a higher standard. Love one another as I have loved you, he commanded. But a love for others, if we're going to love one another as Christ has loved us, well, if we don't love God first, are we going to be able to obey the second commandment and properly love others if we don't have that love for God first? And Jesus said, on those two commandments hang all the law and prophets. Every other commandment's going to come from that. But if we had that first commandment down, if we love God, if we love him with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, he will then be the reason for every decision we make in life. Won't he? If we love Him, if He occupies the only place for us, and if we're thinking, I love God, I'm going to serve Him, I'm going to live for Him, I'm not going to live for myself, then we're going to be thinking in every circumstance, okay, how in this situation, what I decide, how can I best serve my God and fulfill His will and glorify Him? If that's how we're thinking, then when it comes to who we marry, is that going to make a difference? What's it going to do with all those other reasons? That's going to put that away, because then we're going to be thinking about, is this person that I'm going to marry, is that going to help me to fulfill God's will? Is that person going to help me to get to heaven? Is that person going to help my children to get to heaven? Of course, along with that, we've got to be thinking, am I going to help that person get to heaven too? I mean, would that be fair to them if we were going to mess up their lives or their eternity? So that we got to be fair about that, don't we? If you want somebody that's going to help you to get to that standard, we got to be that standard ourselves too, don't we? So we got to think about that. But if we love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, that's what we're going to be doing. And then we want to marry somebody else that has exactly that same priority. Then that's the right reason, the right basis for that decision. And what decision are we going to make in life? And of course, we see what the first decision there is, to serve God. That's the biggest decision that we, and we're going to have to decide whether we are or aren't. I mean, that is the issue of our lives, that question. As Joshua said, choose you this day whom you will serve. We have to make that choice. We have to choose who we're going to serve. Is it going to be God or somebody or something else? God or not God? That's number one. And that's going to determine where we spend our eternity. But if we make the right choice there, I mean, what is the next biggest choice we're going to make in life? What other choice are we going to make that's going to have more to do with how our life on this earth goes and what's going to end up for us in eternity and for all of our descendants other than who we marry? Can you think of another one that's even close to it?
Of all the ways to be yoked together, that's the ultimate.
That is the ultimate. Yeah. And there's a reason why we should harp on this. There's a reason why God harps on this right here and everywhere else. That's why we need to be looking and making our decision based on this standard. So Solomon went wrong because he was choosing a different reason for who he decided to marry than the right reason. And it just so happened, along with that, he was breaking some explicit commandments of God on that issue for him. Well, we have commandments too, and we looked at some of those last time, and Brother Jan brought out that one that he just quoted there again in 2 Corinthians 6:14 through 18, where he says, "Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers." What communion does light have with darkness? Does the temple of God with idols? There is none that doesn't go together. So, I mean, that passage is not explicitly in the context of marriage, but it certainly applies, because how are we going to obey that commandment and then marry somebody that doesn't love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength? Then we're yoking ourselves together with someone that, if we love God like that, then there shouldn't be any communion there with. Well, and that's not to deal with issues in a lot of cases, and this is why we can see passages like we have in 1 Peter chapter 3, those first seven verses there. When you do have a marriage of a Christian with a non-Christian, there's only one way that should happen. What is the one way that a Christian could end up being married to a non-Christian where the marriage itself in the beginning was not something that was violating those commandments, like to be not unequally yoked together with an unbeliever?
One of the two decided later to obey God.
Yeah, it's when they both start out as unbelievers. I guess you could look at it the other way. Well, maybe they were believers and then one fell astray. That would be a real tragedy. But the scenario would be if you have two people that get married, neither one of them are serving God at that time, and then one is converted to the Lord. Well, then you got a situation where you have in the marriage there where you have a spiritual difference. And the Lord has commandments about that. That's not a grounds for divorcing one spouse in that case. We have 1 Peter 3, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. There's many verses, and much of the entire 7th chapter of 1 Corinthians is on that particular subject. How to deal with that, how to handle that as a Christian in a situation like that. But when one is a servant of the Lord, there's no excuse for making a decision then for some other basis for choosing someone to marry. Then is that person, do they love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength? And I know last week we had our Christian Foundations class, so it was 2 weeks ago when we were in this last, but the last passage that we were looking at in here 2 weeks ago on this, when we were in this material, was in 2 Timothy chapter 2. And verse 2, another one that doesn't have the context of marriage per se, but the principle is very much involved in that. And we can go back there and see that again. Brother Samuel, do you have that 2 Timothy 2, verse 2? Okay. Now this is where Paul was, by God's inspiration, instructing Timothy how to do his work in Ephesus to carry on the work that Paul had started there a number of years before on his third missionary journey, when he taught daily in the school of Tyrannus, and by his teaching there, all Asia, that whole province of Asia, heard the gospel of Christ. We're told that in Acts chapter 19. So Timothy was being instructed to follow that same pattern that Paul had used from the start of that work there. This is really how the Lord's work should be done everywhere for all time. But you have Christians who find faithful men to commit these teachings to, so that they will then be able to teach others also. So what standard do you use? Who are you going to send out? Who are you going to send out to go? Because was Paul going to be able to go to every house in Asia Minor? And was Timothy? No. To cover all that ground, just like, and I used to use this passage a lot when I was involved for 10 years in the work over in India. That the congregation here remains involved in, but we're still trying to follow that right there. I mean, think of that. We already mentioned a land that's got 1.25 or a little bit more. I mean, they'll be up to 1.3 billion probably by tomorrow. But at any rate, when you have that many people, I mean, how do you cover that ground? I mean, how do you get the gospel to that many people? I mean, you need to have one person can't meet all those people. I mean, that should be pretty obvious. You need as many people out there as possible to do that. Well, how do you do that? How do you get those people? Well, there's the pattern there. You got to find those faithful men. They need to be grounded in it, then they need to go out. Then if that one is finding someone faithful, I mean, it multiplies in that fashion. But look at the standard though. If you send somebody out to preach and they don't love the Lord with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, I mean, how are they going to go out and effectively preach the gospel of Christ? In fact, what are they likely to do? Matthew 23, what did the Pharisees do when they were compassing land and sea to make one proselyte?
It says they made twofold more the Son of God than themselves.
Yeah, so there wasn't a lack of zeal on their part. They were willing to go land and sea to convert one to what? I mean, when they themselves were corrupt and they didn't love God, what were they going to convert them to? And we've seen lots of examples of that sort of thing in our modern time. We saw it over there in India too, and it's a sad thing. But and there are a lot of corrupt individuals that will try to find the money train, and so they'll get involved in things like that to try to make money. Well, if somebody's motivation to preach the gospel is money, is that someone who's faithful? Is that someone who loves God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength? Or do they have... That doesn't go together, does it? You can't serve God and mammon. But if somebody's serving mammon, what are they going to end up doing? It's going to be corruption. And that happens. But that's why the Lord says we need to find faithful men. Timothy was faithful. We read about him, the description of him in Philippians chapter 3. Paul said, I have no man like-minded. For all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ. And he said Timothy would naturally care for their state. Timothy, in every decision he made, there was only one thing that was the basis of his decision. What was going to further the cause of Christ and accomplish his will? That's it. Every decision Timothy made was based on that. So with all of his heart, he was going to do the right thing in every situation. We should all be like that. It was rare even in that time. And it's still rare, but we need to be that rare one. And we need to be looking for somebody else who's rare like that too. Message here, don't settle. Can't lower your standards. Well, it's hard to find. Yes, it's hard to find. In fact, Solomon, who had 1,000 wives, when in the book of his repentance about it, and as he was reflecting on that, he had his observation about finding these faithful ones. Let's turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Verses 27 and 28. Ecclesiastes 7, 27 and 28. Oh, Travis.
Behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account. But yet my soul seeketh, but I find not. One man among 1,000 have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found.
Because he married the wrong ones. When he said 1,000, that's the number. He did have 1,000, so he was 0 for 1,000. Well, why? Because he, for the wrong reason. But, I mean, trying to find a faithful man, that's very difficult. And Solomon observed that he had not found one among his 1,000. But he's looking back now, and that's the situation that he had. But let's go over to Proverbs chapter 20, verse 6. Proverbs 20 and verse 6. Brother Michael? Now, to find somebody to tell you how good they are, that's not rare. That's not difficult. But how about finding someone who actually is faithful? Well, here's this is through Solomon again. It's very rare to find that person. And Solomon said of 1,000 women, I haven't found one. So, yeah, this is a high standard, not easy to find. So is the solution, well, just do the best you can, just settle. No, not at all. You've got to find that person. And where's that person going to come from? From the Lord. I mean, the last chapter of this book is Proverbs 31, in large part, is about a virtuous woman, what she's like. And, of course, that would be true of a virtuous man as well. But in Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 14, we can see who is the source of, who's the source of every good and every perfect gift? It's God. Brother Jan, can you read Proverbs 19:14?
House and riches are the inheritance of fathers, and a good wife is from the Lord.
Okay. So there you get the houses and riches again. So, you know, your earthly father may leave that to you for an inheritance. But where is something as rare and as valuable as that virtuous woman of Proverbs 31 is that Solomon didn't find? But she exists. And the men that are worthy at that level, they exist. They're rare, hard to find. But who provides? God does. Brother Jan?
You know, we sing a song when we sing, Wait on the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of those promises that were given, but you know, we have to realize it may not be on our time scale. And I mean, that's true of all of God's promises.
That's right.
That he'll do it in his time.
He will, and if we're, and that's why we walk by faith, not by sight. If we're trying to do it on our own and do it our way, what's going to end up happening?
It's not going to go well.
No, it's not going to go well. And the Bible is full of examples of that. We're looking at one right here on this matter. But we can learn from this one. Here's somebody who really did take matters into his own hands and made his decisions. And we see the reasons why. We see the commandments that God gave and the wisdom of those commandments. And Solomon ignored all that and did it his way. And look at the effects. Well, we can see the effects on him. They turned away his heart from the Lord. So that's what happened. One other one that I didn't put up there, but he mentions it here in verse 1 and again in verse 2. But King Solomon loved, it says. And then at the end of verse 2, he says, Solomon clave unto these in love. So let me put that in there too. That feeling. Now, is it good to love the one you're marrying? I mean, yes, absolutely. But is it possible to get that affection or to have those feelings for somebody that's not the one you should be with? Yeah. And can those emotions cloud your judgment? Very much so. I remember my grandmother, before I was ever married, that's her speech on this was, she said, love is blind, but marriage is an eye-opener. So she was warning me, be careful, don't get your head in the clouds and then you end up choosing to spend your life with the wrong person because that's who you have those feelings for. But that we have to look at what is going to please God, and we have to set all those things aside and be very careful. And that's why if you play with fire, you're going to get burned. And we need to spend our time with those that are the Lord's people and have that kind of standard, because then we get our feelings involved and all of that, and we get a whole bunch of other things that can. And that was an effect on Solomon too. I mean, did he have genuine feelings for these women that he married? Yeah. Was that helpful to him in this situation, or was that detrimental? I mean, that was a way that the devil could use those feelings that Solomon had for those women as an opportunity to get in there to get them to turn his heart away from him. Because when you love that person, then are they going to have influence on you? And if they don't love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, and these women didn't. They weren't servants of the Lord. And so they were working on him, and why can't you just let me have an altar and just let me do this? This is what we do in my family. And if we had time right now, hold the book of Judges and how Samson's... what happened to him when they were, his wife that ended up getting taken from him, and then later Delilah. I mean, look at how they wore him down. They did. They worked on him, and did it have an effect? Yeah, and it will on a person. There's so many examples of this, but Solomon is one of them. And they obviously worked on Solomon. They worked on Solomon because, I mean, for how long now has he been king, and have we seen him being faithful to the Lord in everything and pleasing him? But now we see here, we're in the latter half of his reign, and the seeds that were sown in his decisions of whom he was going to marry, now it's bearing its rotten fruit. And they end up having that effect over time. They turn his heart away from the Lord. It didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen immediately. But it happened. it took time, but with that work, the devil had those ones right there working on him, working on him, working on him, and did it eventually wear him down spiritually? It surely did, and turned his heart from the Lord. Let's quickly turn over to the book of Nehemiah as we're running out of time, to chapter 13. Here the Lord's using this as an example to teach his people. So he's telling us why we have information in the scriptures to learn from. In Nehemiah chapter 13, verses 1 through 3, let's read that. Let's see, Brother Trey, you got that? Nehemiah 13, 1 to 3.
On that day, they read the book of Moses in the audience of the people. There was from written at the Ammonite and the Moabite should not come into the congregation of God forever. Though they met not the children of Israel with bread and with water, but hired the able ones that should curse them. Albeit our God turned the curse into a blessing. Now it came to pass when they had heard the law that they separated from Israel all the mixed multitude.
So what had the people of Israel done? They've broken that commandment. That's the one in Deuteronomy 23, in verses 3 through 6 that we had read before. Solomon broke that commandment too. Well, the people were doing it now. And these are the people, these are from the ones who, of the good figs that the Lord preserved in captivity in Babylon that he brought back to Israel, the ones who had repented. That's who we're reading about right here, those people. Having learned all that lesson of the destruction of their nation and all their brethren, that they had been wiped out. And what was a big reason why they had? Because they had turned away from the Lord. And what was the cause of it in so many cases? What made Baal worship run rampant through the northern kingdom and all those tribes of Israel? Because Ahab married Jezebel from Phoenicia, the daughter of their king, who worshiped Baal. Did that have an effect? You had a wicked man right there who married somebody even more wicked, and it had a lot to do with the spiritual destruction of many of those tribes of Israel. Well, that split in the kingdom that occurred traces back to whom? Solomon, as God's punishment for the wives that he had married. So you can see the ripples of this. But now you have Israel that has all those examples to learn from. And here's that those people that God had brought back. And what do they start doing? They start marrying these women from these nations again. All right, so Nehemiah is dealing with it. So we get down a little bit later. Brother Peter, can you read 23 through 31?
Those days also I saw Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and Moab. And the children spake half in the speech of Ashdod, and could not speak in the Jews' language, according to the language of these people. And I contended with them to curse them, and spoke certain of them, and plucked off their hair, and made them swear by God, saying, "You shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons, nor for yourselves." Did not Solomon, the king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations was there no king like him, who was beloved of God and God made him king of all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did outlandish women cause to sin. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our God and marry and train wives? Read 31.
Yeah.
And one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Elisha, the high priest, was son-in-law of Sanballat, the Horonite. Therefore I chased him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and of the Levites. Thus cleansed I them from all the strangers, appointed that the wars of the priests and the Levites, everyone in his business, and for the wood offering at times appointed.
All right, so there we have really the hall of shame at the end there. It shows that even their very leaders were involved in this thing. I mean, the priests are doing this, and these are the ones that are supposed to be teaching all the people. If they're involved in it, what is everybody else going to be doing? What was the effect here? They were marrying these people from these other nations that God said don't, and their children come along, and what language are they speaking? they weren't even fluent in Hebrew. They spoke half in the Hebrew language and half in the language of Ashdod. Why was that a problem?
The scriptures were in Hebrew.
How are they going to even be able to read God's word when they can't? They're not even fluent in the language. Now, how many Christians today marry wrongly, and then their kids come up and they're speaking half the language of Ashdod, meaning this world. They're mixed. They have some teaching about God, and they have a lot of exposure to the world. And what ends up happening? That's what happened in Genesis 6. I mean, are those children that speak half in the language of Ashdod, are they going to marry righteous people, and are they going to bring up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? This is going to go downhill fast. And that's why he was stopping them. He made them put away those wives that they were marrying of those other nations. But and he used whom as an example? Solomon. If Solomon were, with all that wisdom that he had, and if his heart got turned away, which one of us is so special that it won't hurt us? So that's why he uses that example. All right, well, we're out of time this morning. Appreciate everybody being here. We'll pick up there where we left off, Lord willing, next week. Let's see. Brother Aaron, will you lead us in prayer?